Tonight on Arena, The Surfer, The Wedding Banquet and Ocean are the movies up for review. And Andrew Meehan tells us about his latest novel, Best Friends. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Film reviews this evening to get us started. Fascinating career renaissance of Nicolas Cage continues with The Surfer, set in Australia, directed by Irishman Lucan Finnegan. It sees Cage come into conflict with some very territorial and scary local surf dudes. A remake next, The Wedding Banquet, A Marriage of Convenience, the story with a modern twist. And legendary broadcaster and all-round legendary human being, David Attenborough, brings us a feature documentary on the Earth's oceans. Tara Brady and Declan Burke have been to the cinema and they're with me in studio. Now, we'll start with The Surfer. You always have to check, I suppose, Tara, when you it's a Nicolas Cage film, which mode is he in for this particular outing?
Well, I think Nicolas Cage, I mean, there's one mode throughout his career that you can rely on. And if you think back to the very peak of his stardom, it didn't matter if he was in David Lynch's Wild at Heart, mm-hmm. and it didn't matter if he was in a conventional romantic comedy like Moonlight with Cher, which was a great film. But he always had that kind of barely suppressed rage thing going on.
Yeah.
And what's really great, I think, about the late Nicolas Cage career is that he's really leaning into that. And he's doing a series of increasingly unhinged roles in which he gets to be increasingly unhinged. there have been films like Dream Scenario, if you remember that one, Declan, from where he starts appearing in people's dreams and everyone really loves him, and then the dreams get a bit nightmarish and then everyone really hates him. And he's finding his way, finding projects that really like suit this, in which he can go properly bonkers
and
all the way
through. It has to be said, in the case of this film, The Surfer, Declan, you can understand his rage, and it is rooted in a more realistic place, I think, than many of the previous Nicolas Cage's rages were rooted.
Yeah, we're in a fabulous setting here where the character Nick Cage playing the surfer, he's back in his old childhood home in Australia, Luna Bay, where he has all these wonderful memories of surfing the waves, and it was where everything was possible and so forth. So he has taken his young son, his teenage son, out of school to play hooky. They're going to surf the waves.
And they are simply referred to as the surfer and the kid.
That's their names, according to the script. And it's you know, it's going to be a wonderful afternoon. But as you said, are thwarted by the Bay Boys.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's have a listen to a very early encounter, and the Luna accent is fairly thick. It has to be said in places, and certainly in the case of some of the locals. But you'll hear Nicolas Cage. They're making their way down to the beach, and a guy kind of just bangs his surfboard off the young fella as he's walking past. And from very early on, you get a sense that, none of this is happening by accident.
We got to get out there, though. It's the best place to show you my big surprise.
Oi! Lanku's Army!
Look, it's quiet out there. We'll respect the line. We won't drop in. Kid's a fantastic surfer. Just wait till you see him.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
I grew up here.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
Hey, Dad.
It's okay. You're scaring my boy. Get out of my personal space.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
There you go. Don't live here. Don't surf here. Fairly clear instructions there to Nicolas Cage as the surfer, and his son Flynn Little in the background there with the local guy kind of making it clear to him, Tara Brady, that he just isn't wanted. And that just seems like a little bit of territorialism, but it gets worse and worse as the film progresses. He goes to the coffee shop and he's basically, manhandled out of the place and the coffee's thrown over him.
Well, this leans into the really classic exploitation films, as they called them in the 1970s, like movies like Wake and Fright, where someone who's a bit too pommy for the locals' liking would end up in the outback, and the outback town isn't remotely appreciative of them. Now Nicolas Cage is not at all pommy, it must be said, and they barely make any excuse for his accent. I think there's some point about, I left here during childhood, so he could just be Nicolas Cage. Yeah. But there really is a sense of menace around, like, particularly with Julian McMahon, who's absolutely excellent in it. And, you know, he's a character actor; he's knocking around for years, but he's really genuinely terrifying as the kind of leader of this pack. Mm. And there's a sense that there's some kind of weird religious cult, and you're not too sure what's going on. But also, it really plays with what's happening in his mind and what's actually happening to him, and how much of this is real and how much is imagined. And you're genuinely not sure. So it's incredibly unsettling to watch. And the fact that it takes place under this baking hot sun for most of the runtime as well is really disconcerting.
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of horror scenarios that you're expecting to happen, you know, at night in a creepy forest or something like that.
And one of the interesting aspects, I think, beyond all of this kind of horror thing, which is there in the background for sure, Declan, Nicolas Cage, the surfer, is there with the kid, his son. So there's a father-son relationship there. And without giving too much away, we realise that there's a Nicolas Cage has a son, and his father, that relationship is kind of discussed and pursued. Nicolas Cage is wearing a watch that his father's given. The surfboard that he has is his father's surfboard. So there's something from the past at him as well.
Yeah, very much so. There is a tragic backstory that is frequently alluded to as we go through, and we won't give away too many spoilers. But the character, the surfer, he is absolutely determined to reconnect with this idealised, this mythologised world that he has of his childhood years, because he thinks that's going to make his current life
perfect.
It's going to fix everything. And of course, we know that it's not. But as Tara says, we do get these kind of almost flashes, surreal crossovers between what he believes his life is and what other people, how other people see, you know, what he truly is. It's unsettling, as Tara says. Reminded me in ways of Vivarium, which was,
Loughran Finnegan's
strongest film to date.
Irish director here. Yeah, I remember he spoke to us around the time. I think he was filming this film, The Surfer, at the time he was last in with us.
Very good.
You were saying, though, that it feeds into that same theme.
It reminded
me
of a similar kind of transition between a kind of a cold, hard reality that we're looking at this beautiful landscape, and then we get this very fuzzy perception of the world through the character of the surfer's eyes, and it's very effectively done.
Stars from you, Declan?
I think it's good, it's enjoyable. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Solid 4, and I think we're getting the good Nicolas Cage for sure here. Yeah. What starts from you, Tara?
Yeah, I think it's Loughran Finnegan's best film today. Yeah, 4.
Yeah, that's great to hear. So The Surfer, directed by Loughran Finnegan, 4 from both Tara and Declan. Let's move on then to The Wedding Banquet, and this is a remake, a remake of a fairly recent film, essentially, Tara. Remake isn't probably quite the right word, is it?
that would be an ecumenical manner. It's a reimagining, I suppose, is what we call it, to use studio speak. But you're right, it's a really strange idea to remake a film from like 1993, which, if you're me, just felt like, you know, just 5 minutes ago. It's not an obscure film either, because it was a big breakthrough film for Ang Lee who's an Oscar winner, and it was certainly, like, I remember it being a kind of staple of the DVD store. So it wasn't overlooked. Yeah, it won awards. It was a big thing.
It was a kind of a mainstream film at the time.
The central idea was it was a bisexual Taiwanese main character who was living in San Francisco with his long-term male partner, and suddenly the elderly parents come over, so they have to put together this sham wedding, and at the end of the film, there's this absolutely brilliant moment where the father presents his son's male partner with a bridal envelope, and it's actually just such a
very lovely, touching moment.
And you realise he's been wise to them all along.
So this is that's the Ang Lee film. So we're in modern day Seattle for this one, Declan?
Seattle, and it's very firmly set in the Asian American LGBTQ community, and that's an integral part of the story. We have Angela, who's played by Kelly Marie
Tran. This time we have two gay couples,
a lesbian couple, Lily Gladstone and Kelly Marie Tran. They're desperately trying to conceive, they're in a long term relationship. And then we have Bowen Yang and Chan, and they're a gay couple, and Min is kind of on sabbatical in America from Korea. And
nobody in Korea knows about his gayness or his gay relationship.
Certainly not. And he comes from a wealthy family and so forth, very conservative background. And effectively, what, to cut a long story short, so Min proposes to Angela so that he can pay for their fertility treatment, and in return he gets the green card that allows him to stay in the States and not go back to Korea. Oh my God,
but
I got all that.
Granny in Korea is not going to be happy with that. She's still going to want to come over, Tara.
Oh, well, she does come over. But I mean, here's the problem. It's one of the reasons why I was going over the original plot, is that in order, they're trying to make this concept work in a kind of, in a world where it's not at all taboo to be an LGBTQ couple. And you have these two couples who are very kind of very sitcomish and who are like walking in and out of each other's houses, and there's very much that vibe. And so when Granny arrives, and Granny's played by Young Jung, who won an Oscar for Minari a couple of years ago, she actually gets very quickly on board with the sham marriage for an unseen grandfather who never appears. But because that's the case, and because they've tied themselves in knots in order to kind of make the plot work without the sham wedding being a sham wedding, there's not really that kind of tension, and there's not really that kind of like screwball energy that you got from the first one, where they're frantically trying to cover.
Yeah, and in the clip that I'm going to play, I think you get a sense that this, instead of going the screwball route and sticking with it and giving us a rom-com, they start to go into kind of serious mode and about where these relationships, the two relationships and the paternal, maternal relationship, could they help to conceive the child, where all of that starts to become a source of rouse, effectively, as you will hear in this clip. They're all shouting at each other and they're using a lot of bad language as they're doing so.
I talk about stupid, unsafe sex. Hey, 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 I'm talking to you. I mean, how much more of this do you expect me to put up?
That's
you.
Shinny, the fact.
Put down the fucking phone and listen to me.
So where do you get off?
This whole thing was your idea, you fucking busybody. Wei wouldn't even be here but for you. And I wouldn't have to deal with any of this shit.
Shit! I'm shit! You're a shit! You're all shit!
I wasn't calling you shit.
Don't call me anything! You user! You fraud!
There we had Bowen Yang as Chris and Hang Ji Chan as Min, the two male the two members of the male couple, and Kelly Marie Tan as Angela, who's one of the lesbian women, and they're all tearing strips off each other, obviously, and the Korean in-laws are watching all of this. One of the interesting sides to this too is that Angela, the lesbian woman who's in this open marriage, her parents know about it and her mother's right behind her, and when Angela starts explaining to the mother, "I'm going to have to pretend that I'm married to my pal, the gay man that you know," the mother's appalled that she's covering up in that way.
She is absolutely outraged. Her mother, May, who's played by Joan Chen, is not just an ally, but she's so enthusiastic an ally that she's actually embarrassing to Angela. And she, as you say, she's outraged that her darling lesbian daughter might even consider deigning to marry a man.
Yeah, and for all of that, it seems to fall between then the two stools of screwball comedy and let's have a bit of fun and a nice romantic ending, and trying to treat the issues seriously, Tara. What does that mean in terms of stars and overall for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't think it worked. I didn't think it worked at the level of the narrative. Technically, it's all over the place. You're just there going, why is the camera over there? Like, there's like really strange shots and edits. So by any metric, it's kind of a bad film, but it is very sweet and small-y. And I do love Bowen Yang and Lily Gladstone. So we'll give it a three and let it be.
Three and let it be. Live and let live, that sounds like to me. And what are you saying, Declan?
Yeah, it depends on your perspective on the Asian American community and how conservative it actually is in terms of its how it perceives the LGBTQ community. It's a less mealy-mouthed three from me, a very enthusiastic three from me. It's a satire that doesn't really know what it's satirizing, I think.
All right, okay. Well, those are our first two films, The Surfer and The Wedding Banquet. Tara and Declan are staying with us, and we'll be coming back to talk more about Ocean with David Attenborough. All right, and let us move on then to a feature documentary from David Attenborough. An event in itself, it has to be said. Mm-hmm. Ocean with David Attenborough, Tara. Not many people can claim to have been on the earth for as long as him. Today, this very day, is his 99th birthday. Yeah. I mean, he's the man we all want to be when we grow up. It's extraordinary.
He's a testament to doing what you love. Will definitely. And I mean, it's one of the, like, he opens the film saying, after living for nearly 100 years on this planet, I now understand the most important place on earth is not on land but at sea. But like, I mean, what's fantastic about him is he's there looking at, it's not like kind of the prettiest ocean documentary, because it's not the whales and dolphins kind of documentary that we're all used to. It's not the Blue Planet. It's much more about the, like, underground or underwater kelp and the forests and the meadows, and he is just like so excited to talk about this at 98 years of age.
99.
Well, 99 today. But
he was 98 when he did the VO.
He's so excited by all of these discoveries. He's so excited about this unexplored territory and, you know, things that basically we would not have been able to look at 20 years ago. And it's also a campaigning film because there is a UN meeting about the ocean next month, which is one of the reasons why the film has all these kind of very glossy kind of producers like Prince Albert of Monaco. But it's a sort of plea to, you know, we're not against fishing, but we are against things like industrial fishing, people trawling the ocean bed, people absolutely destroying things. And we're definitely against the fact that this is subsidized for millions and millions of dollars. And he makes all this really as a really, really elegantly argued.
Yeah, well, he just had such elegance in his delivery anyway. And then the scripting matches the elegance of his delivery. However, it may be anti-industrial fishing. It's kind of pro-shark, though, as we shall hear.
We once believed that if you removed the sharks, there would be more fish. Now we are learning how wrong we were. We are seeing that the entire reef depends on all of these relationships. If just one is removed, everything and everyone that relies on this coral community could be in trouble.
David Attenborough in Ocean with David Attenborough. And as we were listening to that, Declan Burke, you were saying just the timbre of that voice. And it still has exactly the same sincerity and power and control that it had when I first heard it, I don't know, 30 years ago maybe?
Absolutely. But that enthusiasm and passion that Tara's talking about, that's implicit in everything and the integrity. As Tara says, it's a campaigning film, so it's not going to be the big screen Blue Planet version. But having said that, and he's not just talking about industrialised fishing and so forth, he also shows the other side. He talks about hope for climate change and how the ocean can bounce back, you know, if it's allowed to. And he gives examples of, you know, conservation and so forth.
That has worked in different places around the world.
And brilliantly done. So maybe not the most beautiful film he's ever made, but possibly the most important one. Yeah. And the fact that it's come so late in his career is really a testament to everything he is achieved.
I don't know whether you dare on his 99th birthday to deduct any stars, but you are entitled to do so if you so wish.
No, look, it's 5 out of 5. It's David Attenborough, maybe his last film, as you said.
99 out of 99. What are you saying, Tara?
Well, it's a 4-star film in terms of visuals. As I said, it's not as pretty as like Dolphins, but I mean, 5 stars all day long for David Attenborough.
Absolutely. I think we would all agree with that. Ocean with David Attenborough, The Surfer and The Wedding Banquet are 3 films on this Thursday evening with Tara Brady and Declan Burke. The notorious German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl was instrumental in cultivating the aesthetic and ideals of Nazism in the film The Triumph of the Will, Riefenstahl's record of the Nazi Party Congress in Nuremberg. She went on to make Olympiad, a chronicle of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, which was commissioned by the Nazi government and released on Hitler's birthday in 1938, just weeks before Kristallnacht. These films gloried in bodily perfection and Aryan superiority, and they were crucial crucial to the consolidation of Nazism in Germany. Throughout her 101-year life, Leni Riefenstahl denied being a Nazi, maintaining publicly that her motivations were exclusively artistic and that she knew nothing of the concentration camps and gas chambers. But a new documentary, based on a thorough examination of Riefenstahl's personal archive, shows that she privately revelled in the support she received from former Nazis and members of the German public who mourned the demise of the Third Reich. The film is simply called Riefenstahl, and it's the brainchild of the renowned German journalist and TV presenter Sandra Maischberger. She interviewed Riefenstahl in 2002 and secured access to the personal archive after the sudden death of Riefenstahl's partner and keeper of the flame, Hirst. Sinead Egan spoke to Sandra Maischberger about the documentary, which opens in Irish cinemas this weekend. Before we hear from Sandra and Sinead, let's hear a clip from the documentary. This is taken from an interview Leni Riefenstahl did with the BBC in 1976.
You say you were just there to take a picture of what was going on there at Nuremberg.
Yes, absolutely.
But
it was nothing made for the film. I was only 60s before the rally was starting in Nuremberg.
But you have been quoted as saying that it was staged for your benefit. Many of these...
No, this have written journalists, but not I. But it was nothing staged.
Well, I've read what other people have said about it. You've probably read them also. There was one critic who said that this film could never have been made by anyone not fanatically at one with the events depicted. And another critic called it a hymn of praise to brute strength and mindless hysteria.
That is the opinion of critic people. They have this opinion, but this has nothing to do with the truth.
Sandra Maischberger, welcome to Arena. Before we get into how this film came about and how you came to have access to the estate of Leni Riefenstahl, can you just remind us briefly of who she was?
Well, Leni Riefenstahl was the director and one of the only women in the high circle of the National Socialist. She was a friend of Hitler. She was doing the propaganda we know film-wise about Hitler. She was the director of Triumph of the Will, one of the greatest masterpieces of propaganda maybe in the history of the last century. And she was a very controversial woman, and she lived until she was 101 years old, so she had control about the tale of her biography, and so she kept in control, and she gave a picture of who she was, which was not quite correct.
And is it possible to put into context how important these two feature films were that she made, Triumph of the Will and Olympiad? How important were they to the advancement of Nazism?
Well, she designed the image of Adolf Hitler for the German audience. You have to understand the Germans. It was a must to go to the theater movie to see these films. The first about the Nazi party rally, and she designed what we is called the Führerkult. So she put him into scene, creating the image of the one and only leader of the German people. And that is not to be underestimated, because I think that most of people didn't get a chance to see the Führer themselves. And so they got their picture of him through her picture, through her film work. And while the Olympic Games was another piece, it was financed by the National Socialist Party as well. And it was a huge piece of propaganda for Germany at this time, in the 30s, because in this time there were no concentration camp, so people in the whole world would have a fresh look to this new regime, and she made it look like something heroic, something good, and that was the propaganda work for the people internationally.
And she had a very particular aesthetic, which is, you know, it's become so well known, I suppose, and it's very much centered on the beauty of the human form, the beauty of the male athletic form. And it was very highly admired and influential at the time.
Yes, and it still is. I mean, we're watching like a feature film like Dune Part 2. There is so much triumph of the will in this kind of films. And I mean, George Lucas, when he made Star Wars, he was referring to Leni Riefenstahl. And Quentin Tarantino said he's one of the most influential directors of the whole world. And so her aesthetics were there all the time. And this was one of our questions when we started to make this documentary about her work. If her aesthetic is still here and, you know, preserving, what about if the ideas who created the aesthetics, the ideology, was still there too? So this was the starting point of our film work.
So the film is really fascinating because it features interviews from the 1970s with Leni Riefenstahl as an older woman. And her constant refrain is that she was operating merely as an artist, that she was apolitical, and that she was merely working from inside the Third Reich as if she was somehow separate from the political realities of what was going on. And how did she maintain that position?
Right. That was my question, because I did an interview with her like 20-something years ago when she was about to be to have her 100th birthday celebrated. And I left this house after 2 days with all this echo of her saying, you know, I was never political. I'm just an artist. I would have done these films for everybody who would ask me to. And I was sure that is not the truth. But I wasn't sure, is she lying to me, or did she lie to herself so many years already that she didn't know the difference anymore between truth and lie? And what we found going through the 700 boxes of estate was the clear proof that she was a very political woman. She was much more a fascist already before she knew Adolf Hitler. She did not wanted to, you know, get to connect with him because she wanted to have the fundings for her films from the most powerful man in Germany. She came to him because she shared his ideals and ideology. So she was much more a political artist than I thought she would be.
And in the film, we do see that she is connected with the senior Nazis. We see letters that she wrote to Hitler. We see that she worked very closely with Goebbels. And we see also that she was extremely close with the architect Albert Speer. So, you know, what did you discover about those relationships when you were looking through this mammoth archive?
Well, we discovered, because she, after the war, she always would admit that she admired Hitler, but she would always say just as a person, she was fascinated, but she always denied that she was a part of this ideology. So this was something we discovered on a big scale in the archive, that she was really part of the fascist ideology. And for Albert Speer, he went to prison after the war because he was convicted of war crimes. He was very lucky that at this time where he was in trial, the evidence was not that already so accurate, because otherwise he would have ended up being hanged like other Nazi generals. Yeah. So we found that there was a very close relation to those very important figures of the Third Reich. But we also found that she was very much into like a Nazi network after the war. And that was not only old Nazis from the 30s, but it was new Nazis and very young people sharing the same ideas in the 70s, 80s, 90s until her very death. So she was still connected to a Nazi network for the whole life.
Yeah, I mean, it's really striking at one moment when you have this clip from a television kind of debate that she took part in 1976, where she was debating with another older lady of the same generation, but this lady really takes her on. And it's a controversial moment because we see these messages of support that come to her in the aftermath of that television interview. Can you tell me about that? Because my understanding from watching the film is that that was a real landmark moment.
Yes, it is. It was, for me, it was one of the most important findings in this archive, that she taped all, you know, she taped all phone calls she would do and receive. So we had another Leni Riefenstahl, one which was not hiding her ideology, because she was talking to people who shared her ideas. So this talk show was a moment in history in Germany after the war where she could talk to this woman and persuade the whole audience that she was the victim and not the woman who was persecuted by Gestapo. So she knew everything about what this regime was about. But Leni Riefenstahl got on the audience because she lied to everybody. She said, "I'm not political. I'm the victim here." And in the end, the people would believe this lie because they wanted to believe it. In the 70s, there were many people, or millions of people in Germany, who wanted to get rid of the past after all. And so there was a woman. They knew that she was very much connected to Hitler. And they said, after all, if she didn't know about concentration camps, how could we have known? So Leni Riefenstahl became a figure and a symbol for an excuse for the German society after the war that nobody could have known about the atrocities of this regime.
And how sustainable is that position, or was that position, that she was oblivious? I mean, did people really believe her that she knew nothing of the gas chambers, for example?
Well, you know, we live in a current where people maybe are not really about is it a lie or not. They just want to believe what they believe. And even if they know that it couldn't be true, they still would follow the lie. Now, of course, I knew that she knew about the concentration camp. Of course, the biggest part of the German people would have rumors in the 40s yeah. about the atrocities, but really knowing what happened there was not for everybody. But Leni Riefenstahl knew, because she took the extras for a film she did in the 40s, Tiefland, Lowlands. And so she took people, the gypsies, from the camps. And she was aware that they would go back to the camps. And what we know now, because it just came up, a net of evidence we just heard from a relative of one of those gypsy families who approached us after the film was shown in Germany now, he said that she saved his grandmother from going to the camps, something she never would admit in the 50s, 60s and 70s, because admitting that she saved the family from the camps mm-hmm. would have meant that she admitted that she knew about the camps. Yes. So she got away with the lie, and she stuck to the lie because it was better for her and her life to pretend. And people wanted to know, and the people wanted to believe this lie.
I want to go back to your own interactions with Leni Riefenstahl. You interviewed her in 2002, as you said, and it was one of her last ever interviews. What was it like to meet her, this master of propaganda, and who seemed so invested in managing her own image?
Well, you see, she from a woman's point of view, I would have loved to see her as a role model, because the Leni Riefenstahl of the 1920s was a feministic kind of person. She conquered the world for herself. She mm-hmm. just, you know, she went to films, she went to mountain climbing, she changed to be a director, she produced films. So there was something fascinating about her for me to discover. But I was my question was, why did she turn the wrong way? Why did she do these films for the Nazis? And meeting her at her age, in, you know, she was 100, she was so much full of energy still. Mm. And there was a power, and she was, for sure, she was a diva. And she behaved like one. And there was always this, you know, this kind of fascination with this figure. And on the other side, knowing exactly what she did, it's very difficult to find a kind of an empathy for her.
I can imagine. And Sandra, Leni Riefenstahl was such a controversial figure in Germany, and she also had such a long life. How yeah. have Germans come to feel about her in the end?
Well, she always had a big fan club, people who would only want to look at her as a big artist, who would never, you know, care about what she did in the Third Reich, who would want to separate art from politics. And so there was a broad fan base. On the other side, there were many people who would love to cancel her in our days, because they said, you know, we know she was a Nazi. Why should we talk about her any longer? So there were really two sides apart. And I think for the rest of the German audience, there's something to discover about Leni Riefenstahl, which is not so much about a historical figure, but much more about present questions we have to ask ourselves in times where fascist ideologies are coming back, where propaganda is part of our daily life, where we look at lies being so successful internationally. So I think it's much more now that we discover that Leni Riefenstahl is a role model for how not to behave in such a regime.
Well, Sandra Maischberger, congratulations on the film and thank you for talking to Irina.
Thank you so much for having us, for having me.
Ms. Riefenstahl, if you had your life to live over again, how would you live it?
I think my life was very hard, but also very rich. I think I would say yes, I want to live again.
The same way you did?
This I don't know. I hope I would make so many mistakes, yes, but...
What do you think are your mistakes?
My mistakes?
Yes. Would you say that one of them was your close association with Hitler? Do you feel that that was a mistake? Looking back now.
And of course, she wouldn't answer that question. That was a clip of the Nazi filmmaker and propagandist Leni Riefenstahl interviewed in 1965. And before that, you heard Sinead Egan speaking to the journalist and German filmmaker, TV presenter rather, Sandra Maischberger, about the film Riefenstahl, which will be at selected cinemas from tomorrow. Author Andrew Meehan has captivated readers with his nuanced explorations of relationships, often infused with humour and profound emotional depth. His previous works, including The Mystery of Love and Instant Fires, have earned praise for their tender yet unflinching portrayals of love, loss and the complexities of connection. His new novel, Best Friends, in this Meehan returns to his beloved Dublin, a soulful narrative about June and Ray, two 70-somethings who form an unexpected and transformative friendship against the backdrop of the city's coastal landscape. Delighted that Andrew Meehan joins me now from his Glasgow book launch. So sorry to pull you away from all of that, Andrew, but delighted that you can be with us this evening.
Sean, it's a pleasure. I'm very glad to be talking to you. Yeah. I'm actually outside the launch at the moment. Currently, the singer, I don't know if your listeners know the singer, Eugene Kelly of the band The Vaselines, he's just sung the song Getting Older Faster Now in tribute to the book.
Ah, well, there you go. Which is, it kind of, that is a nice thing. Getting Older Faster Now, it's a nice way of introducing us into the two characters here, June and Ray, both 70-somethings. Did you, in your imagination, Andrew, meet these two characters together or separately?
Well, I met them separately in a way. I imagined I had the location. I knew I wanted to write something in the place where I was brought up, Sandy Cove in County Dublin. But I imagined Ray as this kind of guy you'd see cycling around Dunleary Pier, always on his bike to disguise from the fact that his knees have gone and he can't really walk. So he's always on his bike. And June is the kind of, June lives in one of the houses out the back of Glass Tool. She's always on the bench in her garden. It's a messy garden. She doesn't do too much in it. She's smoking rollies, eating Jaffa cakes, not really engaging with the world that much anymore. And I kind of thought of them both and I was thinking sweet thoughts of them, thinking, I'd love them to be in a love story. And I thought, well, why don't they, even though they've lived in the same village, they've never really met each other. So why don't I have them run into each other, as you do?
As you would do. And, I would be careful to describe this as a romantic comedy because it's not that. There's certainly romantic comedy aspects to it. Would you classify the way they meet as a meet cute? Because I must say, it's the most unusual meeting that I have come across in a love story for a long time.
Well, it is a bit of a meet cute, and I can't sort of shy away from that. June has beehives. She has two beehives in her messy garden, and she makes honey, and she goes around collecting jars to put the honey in. And one day she's got enough honey to take to the local shop where she sells the honey. But the owner of the shop decides that June's face doesn't fit anymore. So he says, listen, I want you and your honey gone. So she's standing there with a load of jars of honey that nobody wants. And in walks Ray, like we are in a romantic comedy up to a point. And Ray says, hey, you look a bit sad. What's wrong? And it's about the honey. And he goes, well, listen, I'll buy the honey. And the thing is, we later discover, it's not a massive plot point, but we later discover that Ray doesn't even like honey. So when she goes to his house, Ray's got all this, why did you buy the honey? And he goes, well, I thought you looked sad. So that is the meet cute. He buys her honey off her.
But don't be misled, reader, I would suggest, if you think, all right, I can kind of get, you know, there are so many potential cliches with a story of love about two people in later life. You know, one of them has had a terrible past and this is a chance for redemption with love. One of them has had never experienced any kind of love before and this is going to open them up and let them flower out into their total selves. Both June and Ray have had pretty full lives and are pretty happy in their current situations.
Yeah, they are indeed. They're not unhappy. They have jobs. They can afford their lives just about, but they don't have they don't live a life of great expectation, if you like, not to quote Dickens. They don't go through life thinking they're quite humble people. And they possibly think that, I mean, June's definitely at the other end of love. Ray's never experienced it, as you say. So they're not going, they don't necessarily think a love story is for them. I mean, one of my alternative titles for the book was Who Me? As in they don't necessarily, it kind of catches them unawares and they're a bit slow in the uptake. So they're slow, they're wary, they're a bit prickly, they don't really know how to do it, they don't really know how to behave. So I mean, even in a book of 9 chapters, this isn't too much of a spoiler. It takes them 7 chapters for one of them to go to the other's house, because it is quite a slow burn in terms of how do we do this? I don't know.
Well, it also strikes me that, as you say, it is a short book and it's not that nothing happens. Of course, lots of things happen in the book, but it's not about, you know, one plot point leading to the next, you know, oh, and here's the bit where they meet and they're all very happy and here's the obstacle that comes up in front of them and they have to overcome that. Here's the misunderstanding. You know, those tropes of the general romantic comedy genre, as it were. But what you give us, because it is a slow burner, it's in tiny little details, the tiny conversations between the two of them, the tiny moments of connection. It's not high drama that we're talking about here. It's very subtle, small drama.
It is indeed. And I mean, there is, for readers who do want some plot, there is a bit of stuff does happen. Nobody dies in this book. There will be hospitals, though. But the real, as you say, the real connection and my real pleasure in writing it was in those small moments, was in the moments where they're going for a picnic. They're in the garden. They're going to the chipper. They're sitting, because they don't have a great deal of money. They might live in Sandy Cove, but they don't have that kind of Sandy Cove lifestyle. So they're sitting there. So all the things they do are kind of free. So they're sitting down by the cove, just hanging out because they can't really afford to go places. There's a scene later in the book where they do something they never do, which is have a cup of tea out of the house, because they don't really have that kind of lifestyle. So if they've got low expectations, I do hope I'm doing some nice noticing of what it is to be them.
Yeah, it is. It's the tiny. It's those little moments of observation that struck me in the various scenes in the book, rather than yes, of course things happen. And, you know, the plot does carry you along and you're wondering what's going to happen. All of those things are there, but it is about the tiny details, I think, the book itself. Now, I hope you don't mind me saying, you're in your 50s or thereabouts, Andrew, and these two characters are in their 70s. What attracted you to go up the couple of decades to look at a relationship flourishing at that point in life?
God, it was a bit of fascination. There was a curiosity and saying, what would it be like? But I'm also going to say there was a bit of fear involved in writing. And I think activating your own fears and maybe activating the reader's potential fears are always interesting, in the sense of, well, what if you do get to that age? And what if, you know, what if you are alone? What if you are alone and thinking, this is me, you know, and, you know, what if you go home at night and if you don't, you know, it's not likely you will talk to someone for 2 or 3 days if you're not out and about in the world. So a lot of it was about my own maybe worries, and maybe we all have them, into a greater or lesser extent, of thinking, well, what if I spend the rest of my life alone? So you're always dealing with your own fears and your own preoccupations and trying to activate them in a way that will get the reader curious as well. So it was fear and fascination, or fear and curiosity about the process.
Did you speak to people at that point in life? How did you go about researching and imagining yourself into that situation 20 years down the line for you?
I did the thing that writers do, which is look and imagine. But I also did the thing when I'm an academic at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, and I was doing some reading around what people call the paradox of aging, and that in a sense, which I also wanted to question, which is the sense of, you know, our bodies may be declining. There may be decline in that way, but apparently contentment and wisdom increases. But I also wanted to question the notion of, well, does contentment increase? Mm. Are old people sort of wise and cute and happy with their lot? Because I mean, if you read Best Friends, June and Ray are a bit prickly. They do question things. So I didn't want to make them these cute oldsters who just are happy with everything.
Yeah, because again, there are a number. We wouldn't have to look too far around us to think of cliched representations in literature and in film regarding older people. You know, either it's the prickly loner, you know, the Scrooge of the thing who needs redemption, or it's the person who has never had this chance to flower because they've been cowed down or by somebody or by society. You avoid those cliches. Have things changed, do you think, in terms of our representation of older people in literature and on screen?
I'd like to think. I mean, there are some great recent books about, McLaverty's Midwinter Break and Andrew Haig's film 45 Years, which seem to be quite quiet, truthful, even-handed representations of later life and the way they're books about enduring love. There isn't that much. The closing chapter of Olive Kitteridge's of Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge is about people meeting a new person later in life. And I think as long as there's a sense of a balance and a sense of complexity and complicatedness to a representation of later in life, because as you say, we can have the grouchy old person or the cute old person, but usually we're not. Either or both. So I did want the characters to seem as complicated as we all are. I mean, I'm 53 and I'm surprised to be 53. I'm sure I'll be surprised if I get there. I'm sure I'll be surprised to be 73 or 83. So I think we're just the same, but a little bit slower.
You mentioned very early on, Andrew, about the setting of the novel, that you wanted to write a novel set in and around Dunleary and Sandy Cove. How long did you live in Sandy Cove for as a child? It wasn't that long, really, was it?
Not really, and I don't know how my accent appears to people, but I lived there till I was a teenager.
Oh, it's quite definitely still it's a Dunleary, South Dublin accent. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I don't know if that's something to be proud of or not, but I moved to Scotland with my parents who were teenagers, and I ended up moving back to Ireland in my 30s, so maybe my accent came back around then. So I definitely have that feeling when I go back and visit Sandy Cove and visit family members who live near there, of feeling like an outsider there. And I knew I was going to be able to activate feeling like an outsider in this very affluent, upscale village, where you can go to the delicatessen and spend 75 euro and have nothing to eat. The only way I could write about Sandy Cove was to make Ray and June outsiders where they were from.
Yeah.
Because I Sandy Cove is one of the nicest villages anywhere, but I don't feel at home there anymore because I just don't feel as if I fit in.
The other aspect of things I think that would be interesting for listeners is the fact you have a background in the Irish film industry, involved in lots of very successful films. I mean, Song of the Sea, Lenny Abrahamson's What Richard Did, and Good Vibrations, to name but three. You're involved in the development of those things in your role in the Irish Film Board. Did the storytelling that you saw and read and looked at happening in that part of your life, has that fed into your writing?
It really has. And also in my current work as a university, I teach narrative structure. So I do. I'm very, very alive to the way stories are shaped and how chapters and scenes and even paragraphs are put together. So I'm very. I revel in the shape of a story. You might look at Best Friends and think, well, there isn't a great deal of shape to it, Andrew. But it was something I worked quite hard on, and making it seem simple and to have its own truth to it. But then some of the, you mentioned Lenny Abrahamson's films there. I mean, his films are so simple but so profound in their own way, and I'm not claiming profundity for my work, but you know, you don't need an overcomplicated plot for a story to have impact.
Absolutely. And also, you've given it a very nice setting in terms of, if you were thinking about a film along that coast, you know, along Sandy Cove and Dunleary, the pier is there, all of those walks can happen, and two great characters. And there's some great dialogue in the book as well, and marked out very clearly as dialogue in the book. Could you see it making its way to the screen?
Well, it has been optioned for the screen, and I'm working with, I don't know if any of the, your listeners know, the filmmaker Conor Ferguson, who made a very, very impactful film called The Wednesdays a few years ago about a pair of old an old couple who take ecstasy on a Wednesday. And it was a film that won a big award at the Clermont Ferrand Film Festival. So we're developing the film together, and that, in a way, and it's in development at the moment. And, you know, not all films in development get made. Yeah. This is certainly in development, and I'm really enjoying being back with June and Reagan. All right.
Well, listen, hopefully it can develop into something that makes its way to the screen. Lovely to speak with you, Andrew. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sean. Real pleasure.
Inside to you now, and enjoy the rest of the launch and have a glass of wine. Andrew Meehan there speaking to us about his new book, Best Friends, which is published by Muswell Press. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields researched. Liam Mullen was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.